هذه الحلقة بمشاركة أرابيكا، شركة زين، بنك الكويت الوطني.
You know, when people in the US where I am now say MAGA, make America great again, the question some of us ask is, when do you think it was great?
You know I've never been afraid to ask the tough questions, and I plan to continue doing that.
So you can insult the prophet of Islam, but don't insult Elon Musk, don't insult Donald Trump, don't insult Benjamin Netanyahu. That's Western values.
You mentioned you've been getting threats.
So we live in an era where threats are very easy to make in the US and are unfortunately sometimes acted upon by crazy people.
So how free is free speech in mainstream media?
Whoever you are, no matter what, where you're from, you immediately get typecast, pigeonholed, put into certain boxes, especially in Western media.
Is there a specific debate that you remember that has been very tough?
You said you would speak slowly. And I thought, is he going to hit me? And if he hits me, am I going to die? Sometimes you have to play the game.
You have to play the
game. Sometimes you have to walk on that tightrope.
How do you keep the balance?
A great question. Yeah. I don't think anyone's asked me that question.
What's the root of the double standard?
He says Gaza could be like Monaco. Jared Kushner said it could be beachfront property. That's how they see land,
wow.
Right?
Do you feel that the narrative has and the general discourse has crumbled?
They know it. They're panicking.
Where's the United States going for the next four years? Where do you think?
When people say what's going to happen in the next 4 years, I can't tell you what's going to happen in the next 4 weeks.
Yeah. So welcome to Kuwait.
We have headphones on?
Yes, please.
Okay.
There we go. Welcome to Kuwait.
Thank you for having me.
See, one of the things when we were preparing for the podcast, we said, shall we make the conversation in a way where we debate you and argue with you? And then we said, no, that might be...
Good luck.
Exactly. But no, what we really want to get out of this conversation today is to understand your experience, your career, and how, from your perspective, we can better understand what's going on in the West, whether it's the media or what have you. So
okay,
we thought where would be the best place to start from. And I thought, why not start from Swindon,
okay,
where you were born.
People listening in the Arab region, what is Swindon?
Swindon is a city or a town or a village?
Town
in the UK.
Yeah.
But what we noticed is your dad is a first generation immigrant,
yes,
in the UK, and you grew up in the 80s.
Yep.
So how was it growing up? How did it affect you as a person, your personality?
It's a good question. I think it defined who I was from a very early age. My sister and I have one sister. We grew up in Swindon till the age of, I was there till the age of five, so not very long. But I have early memories. I have memories of primary school, or what the US calls elementary school, where my sister and I were the only brown people in that school. I'm sure it's changed today. I haven't been back to Swindon for many years. Mm. But brown folks are everywhere now. But I'm sure at the time, we were the only non-white people. So from a very early age, that idea of being a minority was imprinted on me. My entire life has been defined by being a minority of some shape or form, whether it's religious, ethnic, national, whatever it is. That was defined from a very early age. And I remember one of my earliest memories actually is my mother said to me, make sure you don't eat ham when you go to school. Don't eat pork or ham. And I went to school. I was like, and it was Swindon. And the dinner lady said, do you want a hamburger or a hot dog? So I ate a hot dog. And I thought the hamburger would be... And my mom was mad at me. But those were the days. Yeah. Now, mashallah, a lot of Muslim kids in schools get halal options. You didn't have it in my day.
Yeah, I remember when I went to university as well, there was a Muslim union almost. Yeah. And
you were at UCL, right?
I was in UCL,
that's
yeah.
a Muslim central. That's a great place to be for halal food yeah. and brown people.
Yeah.
It's a great area.
But yeah, even though at the time, I was there in 2016, even though at the time there wasn't a lot of halal food in the cafeteria, so all the Muslim folks got together and they wanted to bring more food. And they did that, which I thought was amazing. But going back to Swindon, and I read in your book and also in an interview that you did or a debate that you were part of in BBC's Question, you said my father came to this country in 1966. Yeah. He used to write lots of letters to newspapers with his views on the stories of the day. And he used to get dog litter through his letterbox in response. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, my dad told me that story. I was like, wow, he actually lived through, you talk about racism of the old school type in abstract. But actually, you know, some of us have parents who lived through that period. And my father moved from India to the UK, part of a big migration of Indians to the UK. But he's a very opinionated person. I get a lot of my political views and my love for debate from my dad. And back in the 60s and 70s, if you wrote to the Times newspaper, the Times of London, they would print your full address. Today they don't do that because of doxing or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But they would put, you know, your full house number, street, etc. So it was very easy for racists to target you in response. So yeah, my dad told me that story about that used to happen to him. I mean, he moved to the UK at a time when, you know, restaurants, hotels, motels, hostels used to have signs outside saying, no dogs, no blacks, no Irish, right? That was the UK in the 1960s and 70s. So it was a very different period. And UK obviously made a lot of progress. But unfortunately, if you're following UK politics now, as in other Western countries, a lot of that progress is being undone.
Undone?
Yeah, we're regressing. Multiculturalism is being disowned.
Yes,
diversity is seen as a bad word. You know, when people in the US, where I am now, say MAGA, make America great again, the question some of us ask is, when do you think it was great? What year do you want to go back to? You want to go back to the 50s, pre-civil rights era? You want to, what year do you actually want to go back to? So there is a lot of regression going on in Western democracies right now when it comes to race, immigration, minorities.
But don't you think that's because the multicultural target was not reached, if I can say, but and people now are losing their cultural heritage as countries. And when you go to the UK now, you don't feel like it's Britain again. That's the general feeling, don't you think?
That's a propaganda line.
Do you think so? Yeah.
I think so. I mean, this is, depends what you define. If your definition is it doesn't feel like Britain because there's not enough white people, then sure, that's true. But if you're not defining it in an ethnic or racial way, then what is Britain? Britain has always been, I know we use the word melting pot for the US, but so is Britain. It was the home to an empire. I mean, you know, there's the famous line about from Indians, which is, we are here because you were there, right? The Britain went around and conquered much of the world, and a lot of those countries still in the Commonwealth sent a lot of people back. And I think that is an important point. When people say multiculturalism has failed, and it's a line that's very popular now, even amongst some liberals, you look at the UK right now, last time I checked, the mayor of London elected for a third time is a British Muslim son of a Pakistani immigrant bus driver. I don't think multiculturalism has failed. I think people want it to fail, but that doesn't mean it has failed.
Okay. So back to your childhood, and I really want to get into your journalism now.
Yes.
And being from a Muslim family, first generation immigrants, they usually pressure you into going into medicine, engineering to secure your future.
Yes.
But you went into journalism. Were you not pressured? How did you end up in journalism?
It's funny you should say medicine and engineering because my mother is a doctor and my father is an engineer. It's a cliched Asian Desi couple there. And yeah, all of their friends are in similar professions, and all of my friends who were, you know, kids of immigrants also went down that route. A lot of doctors, a lot of pharmacists, a lot of dentists, a lot of engineers. My sister and I are both journalists, so we're both disappointments to our parents in many ways. Actually, more to my mother than my father. My father was actually always very supportive. He loves politics. He loves news and current affairs. So I think he lives vicariously through me. You know, I think I do the stuff that he wishes he could have done in some ways, and he had the ability to do. My father's a very good public speaker. But he's a civil engineer by training, worked for the United Nations much of his life, traveled a lot, but very traditional. My mother, I think, still wishes I did something different. I feel like even now, if I told her tomorrow, Mum, I'm becoming an accountant, she'd be delighted, even though I'm 45 years old and I have a kid on the way to university. She's never been a fan of it, mainly because she's a classic Indian Muslim mother, protective, doesn't like the fact that I'm out there picking fights, getting threatened, you know, getting into rows with powerful people. She's very protective, would rather, you know, keep your head down. She said to me one time, she's like, you should just stop talking about Donald Trump. I said, I'm literally a journalist. He's president of the United States. I wish I could, I can't. So this is the world we live in where a lot of parents now are actually changing. I speak to a lot of Muslim American crowds, British Muslim crowds, a lot of them have kids who are doing different things. And I often joke with them and say, look, if you have four kids, maybe only three of them need to be doctors. Maybe one can do something different, a little outside the box. Yeah. We do need people from our backgrounds who look like us, believe what we believe, have had upbringings like we've had, to be in all those spaces, right? I've been an evangelist for Muslims in the West, getting into media and culture and arts and film and politics and public life, public service. We can't just be cocooned off in little bubbles, cut away from everyone else, just being doctors.
You mentioned you've been getting threats. What kind of threats do you get them regularly? Is it every now and again?
It's I try not to talk about it too much because I don't want to empower the people who do it. But, you know, when I do prominent things, whether it's with powerful forces, people don't like it. You know, I did a couple of big debates on Israel last year, which gets a lot of attention. I've criticized the Indian government. And if you've dealt with the Indian government's trolls online, they are crazy. Some of the far right Hindutva trolls. Obviously, the MAGA folks are not fans of mine. You know, I live in the US, which is a sadly very violent society, right? People have a lot of guns, a lot of anger, a lot of violence. And, you know, you've seen in the Trump era threats against public figures, against politicians, against activists, against journalists rapidly increase. We now have a new Trump presidency. We're speaking a week into this new Trump presidency, and people are worried. People are, I mean, you have the richest man, one of the richest men in the world, Mark Zuckerberg, basically bending the knee to Trump. Because he's worried about himself. It's not just, some of it is to do with getting tax cuts and deregulation and getting rid of investigations. But some of it is because Trump threatened to put him in prison. So we live in an era where threats are very easy to make in the US and are unfortunately sometimes acted upon by crazy people. So, you know, I take that stuff seriously, but I don't let it affect my work or my life too much.
Okay, so if you spoke about you as a person, but you also at the Oxford Union, you opened your statement with, as a Muslim, as a representative of Islam, I would consider myself an ambassador for Islam, a believer in Islam, a follower of Islam and its prophet. And as a young, opinionated Muslim journalist navigating a career in journalism, did that help you to stand out, or was it more of a challenge that you needed to...
Well, it's interesting how you phrase it. Did that help me to stand out? It definitely made me stand out. Did that help me or hurt me? I think in equal parts. It's done both. Obviously, being a Muslim in public life, I was one of the few British Muslim journalists in the 2000s, 2010s, right? Yeah. That didn't make it easy because you're very easily stereotyped. You're put in a box. You know, I wrote my first book on Ed Miliband, who was Labour Party leader up until 2015. And I did that very deliberately. I wrote a biography of a British politician when actually a lot of publishers were like, you should write about the war on terror. You should write about radicalization. You should write about Islamophobia. And I said, I do not want my first book to be about a Muslimy issue, right? That would be just too easy to be put in that box. And even that phrase, Muslim journalist, you know, some people argue about it. Are you a journalist who is a Muslim, or are you a Muslim journalist? Now, some might say that's pedantry, but actually it does affect how you're seen and how you're treated. I was one of only three Muslim anchors at MSNBC on American primetime TV for the last 3.5 years, well, until a year ago when I left MSNBC. But it was an interesting time because, again, when things like Gaza happen, people do look at you differently. The average white anchor is not expected to speak on behalf of white people or Christians or America or a particular region. If you're a Muslim or an Arab or an Indian or a Palestinian, yeah, immediately you are held up as a representative of your people because most white people haven't had any interactions with that minority group. I mean, for a lot of people, I'm the only Muslim they've ever seen on television talking about religion, race, Middle East, politics, Israel, whatever it is. So whether you like it or not, I probably wouldn't use that exact phrasing today, 11 years later or 12 years later that I used the Oxford Union. I would never say that I'm a representative of Islam. I would never, that feels too arrogant to me. But whether I like it or not, I'm treated as a representative of Islam. Exactly. Whether I like it or not, we are all ambassadors for Islam. Even the non-practicing secular, my good friend Bassem Youssef, he's a comedian, Egyptian, American, does a podcast with me. He doesn't see himself as some great practicing Muslim. I have no idea what his state of faith. I'm not going to speak for him. But whether he likes it or not, when he comes on stage, he's the Muslim comedian, the Arab comedian. Whoever you are, no matter where you're from, you immediately get typecast, pigeonholed, put into certain boxes, especially in Western media.
Yeah. Okay, so that brings us to your practice and debating and arguing. And this is something that you do very well. In fact, you wrote a book about it, Win Every Argument. What kind of mindset do you get into? Because the way you debate, the way you argue, many people say you're very different than everyone else. You're sharper, and you are able to talk to anyone in any circumstance. But how do you get into that zone? How do you prepare? What's the first thing that you is there a specific routine that you get into before a debate?
That's a great question. Yeah. I don't think anyone's asked me that question. Do I have a routine?
Yeah.
It's a great question. Well, first thing is I try not to eat.
Not to eat.
I try not to eat.
Really?
Yeah, it's one thing people always like when I go to events, people are like, oh, would you like to have a meal? I was like, not before I speak. After, whenever I do speeches or whatever. So
do you afterwards. Not feel hungry, or do you deliberately not eat?
I just deliberately, you know, I just don't want to risk any. I just want to be in a place where I'm not worried about anything inside of me. I don't eat. I never share. Here's a weird thing. My wife made fun of me recently. I never share my remarks beforehand with anyone. which is weird because it contradicts what I say in the book. So I apologize to people watching. And that's just a personal thing. Yeah, don't follow me. Do as I say, not as I do. But maybe in the book, I make it very clear that when you're starting out as a public speaker, as a debater, someone who wants to communicate, make sure you practice in front of others, right? That's how you get confidence. A lot of people say, I can't stand up in front of a million people on television or 10,000 people in a hall. How do you do it? And I always say, start small, start with a few people, start around the dinner table, start with your immediate family, start, do a speech to your friend, get smaller crowds, go from 5 to 15 to 50, and then you'll get to 500, 5,000, 5 million, right? So that's 100%, and I stick with that advice. Me personally, maybe it's superstition, whatever it is, I don't like to share my remark. My wife will say, oh, what are you saying? What are you going to say in this interview? I say, when you watch it, you'll see. Yeah. She'll say, you're not even going to share it with me? And I'll say, no, I don't. Actually, recently I shared a speech with her, and she said, that's weird that you're sharing. You never normally share anything. So I just try and keep stuff to myself. Maybe it's the element of surprise. Maybe it's because I don't want to get feedback, but I don't know what it is.
Do you feel that you might dilute the message if you speak?
Maybe, or you know, one of my favorite football players is Gary Lineker, a great England striker of the 1980s, 90s, now TV host. And I got to interview him last year, which was a great fanboy moment for me. And he said something when I was a kid. I remember he said, when other teams go out before the match begins, and doing practices, he would never do any practice goals or penalties. He'd be like, I save them for the game. I won't do it beforehand. So for me, it's like I'll save my remarks and my tone for the event. So that's something else I do. I mean, look, the main thing I do, which helps me win debates or arguments or at least try and get the better of an opponent, is I prepare like crazy. Like if somebody prepares one day, I'll prepare 3 days. If somebody prepares 1 week, I prepare 3 weeks. Like I'm excessive. I want to know, you know, John Stuart Mill, I quote him in the book, the famous British philosopher, you cannot know your own side of the argument unless you know the other side of the argument and the best version of it. I take that one step further and say, you don't just need to know the best version of your opponent's argument. You need to know their argument better than they do. So when they say, well, did you know there's this study? I need to know beforehand what that study is that they're about to quote. And I need to have the rebuttal for that study and say, OK, but did you know that the study you're citing, it's been debunked by X, Y or Z? So I think for me, the preparation is the key. One of, you know, the great mic drop moments, the bits I enjoy in interviews, is that moment where they say something and I'm just ready for it. I interviewed Vivek Ramaswamy,
yes, you did.
Who is a Republican politician, ran for president, tried to get a job with Donald Trump, but was recently pushed out of the administration before it even began. Poor Vivek. And now I believe he's running for governor of Ohio. And you know, when I interviewed him, he's a very smooth-talking, fast-talking, confident brown man. I was like, we have something in common. And he came on my show. He challenged me to a debate, so I invited him on the show. And he didn't really, I thought he might prepare and come. He didn't. But what was interesting was I had watched several interviews he'd done that week where the issue of a scholarship he had received in university from George Soros had become an issue for him because the right-wingers hate George Soros, the billionaire. And he had this line about, well, in university, he wasn't as rich as he was now. He needed the money. It wasn't too. So I watched those interviews. I knew that every time he cites, oh, if you look at my tax return. So we got his tax returns, went through them, saw that he wasn't really telling the truth about the money. And it's a great moment in the interview when I bring up the Soros scholarship. And he says, Mary, and you see his face, very cocky, thinking in his head, I've got a rebuttal to this. He says, if only you looked at my tax return. And then I pull up the tax returns on screen, highlighted. And you see in his eyes, there's a moment it's like, oh. I won't say the word on there, but ouch. And it's kind of like that moment. For me, when I'm preparing, that is what I live for, right? Other people have great pleasures in life. That's my simple pleasure in life, getting that.
My question was, my next question is about this moment. Okay. Because these moments are tense.
Yeah.
They can be awkward.
Yeah.
And I've seen some even live arguments or
interviews. Yeah, they can be very awkward, especially in person. Vivek was remote.
Exactly.
But in person can be very,
in person can be awkward, let alone sometimes there's an audience.
Oh, yeah.
So
no, audience is better.
Do you think so?
The audience is like a protective. So I do a show for Al Jazeera English called Head to Head, which we used to do at the Oxford Union. Now we do at Conway Hall in London. Having that audience shield is amazing. A, the guest can't BS you in the same way if it's just you and them. Because there's a whole audience watching who will laugh, who will take a deep breath, who will clap, who will sneer, whatever it is. So the audience is always a great. I love live audiences. I live for the live audience shows. And the other reason is when it's all said and done, there's still an audience sitting there when the cameras start rolling. So I'm protected by the audience. When I'm in a studio, I interviewed, I tell the story in the book, I interviewed the current mayor of Kyiv, Ukraine, former heavyweight champion of the world. Why am I having a mind block? Vitaly Klitschko.
Vitaly Klitschko, yeah.
Vitaly Klitschko.
His brother is Vladimir Klitschko.
Both brothers were heavyweights. He's mayor of Kyiv now. Yeah. I interviewed him when he became mayor of Kyiv before the Russian invasion of 2021. But while obviously Crimea was still occupied, and we talked about Russian politics, and he came on the show and he said to me, he's about 6'10" or whatever, he's huge. His arms are the size of my body. And he said, you must speak slowly. My English is not so good. And I said, all right, but I speak very fast, as everyone knows. So I told my producer, say in my, you know, keep me in track in my, if I go too fast, just slow me down. So the big whole first half of the interview, I was very slow speaking. I was like, you know, tourist, English tourist, can you show me the way to the car? I was speaking very, like, did you tell what? And then eventually I got very relaxed with him and I went back to my talking very, very fast. And then I asked him about alleged connections he may have to Ukrainian mafia, which didn't make him very happy. And the interview's over now and the cameras roll and it's just me, him, and one cameraman, no one else in the studio. And he stands up, towering, and he says, you said you would speak slowly. And I thought, is he going to hit me? And if he hits me, am I going to die? And then because I'm so shameless, I was like, but if he hits me, it'll go viral. And it was that viral death. Luckily, he didn't hit me. And a producer came in. I told my producer after, I said, from now on, whenever we have an awkward interview, you must rush into the studio to talk to the guests because it could get very uncomfortable. I interviewed Julia Gillard, former Prime Minister of Australia. And we talked about, does she have blood on her hands for all the asylum seekers drowning off the coast of Australia? And she get when the interview was over, she gave me a death stare and her team came in. And it was very, how long are you in D.C. for? Oh, have you done any sightseeing? I was trying to make small talk. And she wasn't interested. She wanted to leave.
And those moments, what makes you push? Sometimes you push and they're already on their back foot.
Yes.
But you still keep pushing until you wait for a clear answer. Mm. What's, because a lot of people will just stop at this moment.
We'll move on, which is a great frustration.
Yeah, I mean, awkwardness, tense.
No, my principle, motto, whatever you want to call it. It, you know, you answer the question. I'll keep interrupting you. I'll keep, you know, people say, oh, you're interrupting. Oh, you didn't let the guests. I have so many people say, oh, you didn't let the guests speak. Well, because they were BSing me or they were filibustering or they were trying to change the subject. I have no qualms or apologies about interrupting a political guest. If they're on my show and I ask them a question and they are blatantly not trying to answer it and go off somewhere else, do what, especially in the Trump era, everyone does it, especially right-wing guests. It's all filibustering. What about this? What about that? What about Biden? What about them? And they will not answer the question you pose to them. And too many cable anchors in the US, unfortunately, will say, all right, because they've got a producer in there saying, go to ad break. They've got time pressures. I'll say, all right, okay, well, let's move on to the next topic. My position is I don't care about the next topic. We're going to resolve this. One of my heroes journalistically is a British presenter called Jeremy Paxman, who was a very famous Newsnight host in the 1990s, 2000s when I was growing up and I was entering the media. And he famously was interviewing the Home Secretary of the UK in the late 90s, Michael Howard. It's a famous clip on YouTube. Your viewers can look it up. And he asked the same question 14 times. Because the Home Secretary wouldn't answer. And it was a very famous, 14 times he said, did you fire this prison governor? Did you? And it boom, 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 boom. And it was, for me, it was like, oh, what a great moment. Years later, it turns out, Paxman did an interview and he said, I wasn't trying to make a point. It's just the next segment had fallen through and they told me to keep going. So I just kept asking the same question. But at the time, we thought, what a journalistic hero. He wants an answer to his question. But anyway, so I try and follow that path.
Yeah. And speaking of these paths, sometimes paths that you try to follow do not work. And sometimes you'll have, and my question is here about the best performance that you've ever had and the worst one, or the one that maybe you learned from the most. So what, when we had Sheikh Dhakir Naik here, we asked him about his toughest debate and he gave us a really nice story. So what would, is there a specific debate that you remember that has been very tough?
There were a couple that were tricky because, I'll just do three very quickly. Number one, I did a debate on Greece and Germany about 10 years ago during the Eurozone crisis, the debt crisis. And it was in London. And one thing I learned, and if you read my book, the first chapter is on the importance of the audience. Know your audience. Yes. Win over your audience. And one of the reasons is that night, I didn't really prepare for that audience. I went with my good old leftist arguments, which I think were correct. And I had my stats and I had my talking points to get people really roused up about the state of poverty in Greece and how Greece was suffering because of Angela Merkel's austerity policies. The entire crowd at Intelligence Squared in London had paid £50 tickets to come along. This was a well-heeled financial crowd. Even the Greeks in the audience were right-wing Greeks who were pro-German intervention. The audience was not sympathetic at all to my line of argument. I had to approach it from a very different angle. I approached it in an angle where that audience, we lost that debate. And I realized now, it was mainly because I had the audience. And similarly, last year in Canada, I did the Monk debate, which is their big debate in Canada with Douglas Murray.
I remember
who's an old, unfortunate debating foe of mine. And it was on anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Interestingly, the same topic, I won that debate in London.
With Levy.
But that was a different debate in New York. Okay. A few years ago, I did a debate on anti-Semitism versus anti-Zionism in the UK for IntelligenceGator. We won against Melanie Phillips, a right-wing journalist. Same debate in Toronto. We lost last year. But what was interesting was, again, the crowd was insane. Like, they polled the crowd beforehand. It was 62% in favor of Murray's side before we began. In fact, when he walked on stage, the crowd cheered him like Taylor Swift had come on. I turned to Gideon Levy, the Israeli journalist who was on my side. I said, we've lost this debate. There's no way we can win this debate with this crowd. To the point where the crowd were booing everything we said, to the point where the Jewish crowd were booing a Jewish Israeli journalist who was talking about Palestinians being killed, and they were screaming, you're a liar, at him. They booed me when I cited Oxfam. I said, who boos Oxfam? So the crowd, again, a reminder of the importance of your audience, knowing your audience, how to understand your audience, the role that the audience plays in a debate. And we lost that debate. And then, but we never had a chance. And the one that I always remember is I did an interview with the former head of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency. His name is General Asad Durrani, retired chief. And it was a few years after the Bin Laden killing. And I interviewed him on stage at the Oxford Union with a crowd. And this guy was insane. Just no filters. You know, I'm used to like people, politicians, you know, general, trying to dodge answering the question.
Yeah.
This guy didn't care. So I have all these questions, and he's just, so opening question, I'm like, you know, doesn't Pakistan funds the Taliban? And isn't that, yes, the Taliban are freedom fighters. Everyone here should support the Taliban. Huh?
Wow.
What? To a British crowd? That's like, I think that's illegal under British law, what you just said. So I'm like thrown from the first question. Yeah. And he, you know, his style of speech just threw me off. I was like, but you take money from America and then you give it to the Taliban. He goes, don't go to the circus if you can't ride two horses. What? What are you saying? And then there was a whole section we had on Bin Laden at Abbottabad. It was like,
yeah.
Surely the ISI knew Bin Laden was hiding in Abbottabad. He goes, yeah.
Wow.
And I was like, so I've got like 7 follow-up questions. Where do I do now? I've like run out of time. I don't have enough questions to do the interview. The guy's just admitting to everything. So it was a different type of like tricky doing, not because I was losing, but because I didn't know what to do. I've never dealt with someone who's just so blunt. Like I'm used to people defending their positions or trying to evade a question. This guy was like, whatever.
Which interview you remember that you think that was your best performance? If you had to say, well, I want to repeat that performance, that type of performance. I just had a flow state. Everything was working.
I think without shadow of a doubt, it was the interview I did with Eric Prince, the former head of Blackwater Mercenary Company, about the Iraq war and about Blackwater and about his relations with Trump. And we did it at the Oxford Union. To begin with, I have no idea why he agreed to come on. To this day, people said, why did Eric Prince come on? I said, I don't know. If I was him, I wouldn't have come on my show. But he came on. Maybe it was the Oxford Union appeal. Comes on. Didn't do any real preparation, had no good answers. And it was the most viral interview I'd done at that time, at that point in my career. Actually, and the reason I have fond memories of that interview is because I really don't like Eric Prince. He's like, you know, certain guests, you're just being fair. Certain guests, you're like, you stand for everything I'm against. You know, this right-wing Republican pro-Iraq war hawk mercenary company. And there was bits where, for example, I asked him why he called Iraqis barbarians. And he said, oh, no, I was referring to ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And then I read from his book and he didn't know that I had an exact quote from his book. Those are all great moments we've done. And then there was some great moments in that interview where my team, and credit to, I have a great team of researchers and producers, as I'm sure you do. And one of my producers, just minutes before the show began, found a press release from his company in English, because we'd been looking into his work in Xinjiang, China. He'd been criticized for the Uyghurs are being oppressed, about having a facility there. And I said to him at the time, I said, you've got this facility in Xinjiang. And he goes, oh, no, it's all been misunderstood. So, Renak, your company's bragging to you about the money they've... That's a Chinese statement. You've just mistranslated it. And there's a great moment. You go, no, it's from your company website in English that we just printed out before the show. His face. Like, there are some great moments. Like, that interview is filled with great moments. And what's really good about it, two reasons, is number one, it actually established me in the US. I just moved to the US in 2015. A lot of people in America did not know me. People in the UK knew me. People in the Muslim world knew me from the Oxford Union debate. Americans didn't really know me. I was working for Al Jazeera. But that interview went, because he was a big figure in the Trump world at the time, that went mad viral to the point where Adam Schiff, who was one of the lead Democrats in the House at the time investigating Trump, referred Prince to the Department of Justice for alleged perjury because I exposed a lie he told to Congress under oath. So it really had real-world impact. Plus, it helped my career, which is great. Yeah. Plus, it was fun to do because we actually nailed him on so many topics. So for me, Prince is a big one that I remember.
The US is a different market, isn't it?
Well, it's one of those worlds where they're very navel-gazing, unfortunately, in the US. They don't really follow much outside of their borders, outside of their own media. So to break into that media for me was quite hard. And that was one of the ways I did it at the time.
Funny that you mentioned that he described the Iraqis as barbaric. And that really brings us to the next topic in the Western world and the Arab world and how they view the Arab world. And the story began and how we as Arabs and Muslims started rethinking our position in terms of Western values and if we should take them on board is from the Ukraine war, when many Western news channels have described refugees using phrases like European people with blue eyes.
Yep.
They look like any European family you'd live next to. And this is not Iraq. This is a relatively civilized city.
Yes.
So in your opinion, the West has promoted humanitarian values for years, but when put to test, they reverted to tribal values.
Yes.
What do you think happened there?
You know, Mahatma Gandhi was once asked, what do you think of Western civilization? He said, I think it's a good idea, right? This it lives in abstract, right? In terms of practicing its values, very few do it. I mean, I'm you know, I say this as someone who proudly is a Westerner, a European, an American, a Brit. I'm proud of all my identities. But I'm proud of those identities often in abstract. Like I look at the US Constitution, it has a lot of good stuff in it, if only some of it was practiced. Similarly with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or the European Convention on Human Rights. These are great documents in many ways, but how many governments actually live up to them? How many populations? I think Ukraine exposed so much hypocrisy, not just in terms of the refugee double standards where Syrians are coming in and being rejected, whereas Ukrainians are being welcomed. In fact, there was a hilarious, sadly hilarious Channel 4 news package at the time where a Ukrainian refugee is in Birmingham, England, and complaining, I live with too many Muslims on my street.
No like, way.
Hold on, they're born and bred Birmingham, York. Anyways. So this is the kind of double standards on refugees was huge. And I remember I was at MSNBC at the time and my colleague Eamon Moyudino, we used to do a handover and we did a whole handover once where we talked about, we just played clips of them saying all those things that you just said. And astonishing that they would say this stuff just out in the open, the quiet part loud. Oh, these are blonde people. This is not the Middle East.
Yeah.
As if Europe is some peaceful utopia. Europe home to the worst wars in modern history, World Wars One and Two. But not just the refugee stuff. For me, Ukraine was why it's so stark is because of the parallel with Israel-Palestine. For me, that is the real hypocrisy. And with Iraq, right? You had people like in 2014 under Obama, when the first Russian invasion happens and Crimea is taken, you have people like John Kerry talking about, you can never take territory by force. You can never illegally invade another country. Hold on, John Kerry, you supported the invasion of Iraq. America supported the invasion of Iraq. All the stuff they said about Iraq was destroyed when they talk about territorial integrity, you know, all of that stuff, UN Charter. Putin, as much as I don't like Putin, made a valid point that look what you guys did in Iraq, which Russia opposed. And then, of course, you have the real, real double standard, which is since Gaza, since October 7th, where you're seeing two conflicts play out in real time, side by side. And Ukraine has screwed over every Western liberal who pretends that they are consistent on this stuff, because you're seeing it in real time. You're seeing Hillary Clinton tweeting that if you don't want to be accused of war crimes, don't bomb hospitals. And then you see Israel getting a pass for bombing hospitals. You get Russia being accused of being child killers. And then where the record number of kids are being killed in Gaza, nothing is said. The best one of all, the ICC. When the ICC decision, when the arrest warrants came out, first thing I did was to screenshot all the comments from Biden and Americans welcoming the ICC arrest warrants for Putin, saying, good, yes, we support. And then suddenly, oh, it's an illegitimate court. It's an anti-Semitic prosecutor. We don't sign up to this court. Hold on. Israel's not a party to the court. Well, nor is Russia. So all of the double standards that have been exposed by the fact that Ukraine has run in parallel in real time. So we've been able to see the double. It's not, I don't have to say, oh, the Iraq war or Vietnam. It's happening in real time in front of us on our screens. We see one conflict is treated in one way, another conflict is treated in another.
What's the root of the double standard, if you were to understand the roots? There must be something that's causing it.
There are multiple roots. I mean, the fact is Russia is not our ally and Israel is our ally.
Is that it?
The fact is that one is in Europe and one is in the Middle East. The fact is that Russia doesn't have a strong body of people supporting it in America. Israel does. So you have there's a multiple factors here that are at play. But, you know, when it comes, that's at the governmental level.
Yeah.
When you're talking about the public level, that I think you have to reduce to racism, unfortunately. Like the average American or European who displays these double standards, that's not geopolitics. That's not because of AIPAC or oil or some geopolitical factor. That's because, unfortunately, Palestinian and Arab lives is not seen as the same worth as a Western or European or American life.
And this is what we noticed, and that brings us to the second occasion. which was the World Cup at Qatar, and where we as Arabs and Muslims faced a lot of cultural skepticism and attacks, especially regarding the bish that Messi wore before lifting the trophy. Yes. We saw that as an honour, let alone the Emir of Qatar who put that. It's more like a coronation that we celebrated, and that's how we viewed the World Cup. But in return, there were a lot of attacks in the Western media, ignoring the honour of the bisht. And that made us feel that there is a form of cultural colonialism that we still feel part. We can feel it. And it seemed like the West believed it understood us better than ourselves and felt entitled to school us on what what is culturally appropriate. That's our take on really what happened.
Well, you also have to understand that there's racism, right, in general. And then there's specifically Islamophobia and anti-Muslim and anti-Arab racism, which has its own set of tropes, right? And the Gulf in particular is seen through that lens very much so. And often, unfortunately, Gulf governments don't help themselves in that area. I think when the moment Qatar got the World Cup, I wrote a piece, and I didn't even work for people. Oh, you're because I do a show for Al Jazeera, so I often get called a Qatari agent. And I'm a stooge for Qatar or whatever it is. But even before I even worked for Al Jazeera, I wrote a piece for the New Statesman years ago when they got the World Cup, saying this is Qatar phobia, right? You know, if you're going to use the phrase, this is ridiculous. If you're going to use sport to talk about human rights, and I'm all for criticizing sports washing. There's no doubt that a lot of Arab governments are going and buying premiership teams to try and, you know, help their image. There's no debate about that. Criticize that, sure. But the idea of holding one country to a standard that you don't hold other countries to, that I'm always going to criticize.
Yes, sir.
So the classic example with the Qatar World Cup is you take the BBC, for example, the national broadcaster in the UK. They did not show the opening ceremony of the World Cup. Yeah. Instead, they had a one-hour discussion about human rights. When Russia had the Olympics opening ceremony winter, BBC covered it. When China had the Olympics opening ceremony, the BBC covered it. Why the double standard with Qatar? In no world is Qatar's human rights record worse than Russia or China's. In no world. No serious person thinks, as bad as the human rights abuse are in Qatar, as bad as migrant labor is treated in Qatar, no one believes that Qatar's human rights record or impact on the world is more negative than Russia and China's. And yet, even China, you can't even say it's a white thing because Chinese aren't white.
Exactly.
It was more just the Arabs, the Gulf, and this idea that they should be held to a single standard no one else is. I went to the World Cup. I was at the World Cup final where Messi got the... It was a great moment. And by the way, the media tried its best to demonize that World Cup, and yet the failure is such, A, it was the best World Cup final in all history. So whether you like it or not, 100 years from now, people still be talking about the 2022 World Cup final, greatest World Cup final of all time. No debate about that. Plus, if you talk to women who came back to England from the World Cup, they said it's the first World Cup we didn't get sexually assaulted or harassed at.
So it's the safest World Cup.
Safest World Cup. In fact, it's the first World Cup, I believe, you can fact check this, in history, where an England fan was not arrested. Right? Because no alcohol. Oh, wow. You take alcohol out of the equation. Shock, horror.
Yeah.
It reduces hooliganism and violence. So, and it's also, everyone made fun of Qatar being a small place. It actually worked in its favor. It was a one World Cup where you could watch every game.
Yeah.
You didn't have to travel from city. The next World Cup is like all over the place. I mean, the US is huge. Yep. It's also in Canada and Mexico. The one after that is in Saudi Arabia plus. You know, it's, so that World Cup was very revealing of the racist tropes against Arabs.
But you know, since you have a lot of experience.
And no one's denying, by the way, there were legitimate human rights concerns about Qatar and about the labor force. Exactly.
But
holding it to a standard that you don't hold other countries to, that is the problem.
Even Qatar do not say that there weren't any problems with the workforce, and they started to work on it. But back to the propaganda against the Arabs, and that's really I would like to understand from your perspective and your experience.
Yeah.
Do you think the portrayal of Arabs in the Western media and the stereotypes, do you think that's a deliberate propaganda, or is it because of the result of ignorance?
No, I think it's consumed because of ignorance, but the propaganda itself is very deliberate. I mean, I've spent years documenting this stuff. I even taught a course at Georgetown once about this. It's not just in the media or in news or in politics. You go to Hollywood, for example. A very famous scholar of Hollywood movies, Arab-American scholar called Jack Shaheen, wrote a book 30 years ago, well, 40 years ago, well before 9/11. You can't even say, oh, it's because of 9/11. Well before 9/11, he wrote a book called Real Bad Arab, R-E-E-L, Real Bad Arabs, about how all the villains in movies are Arabs and Muslims. So that predates, people say, oh, it's because of 9/11. No, this goes back way further. I'm old enough, I'm a big action movie fan. I watched True Lies, Arnold Schwarzenegger's comedy action movie back in the 90s. And the villain was Art Malik, a British Indian actor, playing an Arab terrorist group leader running a group called Crimson Jihad, if memory serves me correctly. And they're all idiots. They're not just, they're all incompetent. They can't run the camera for the hostage video. Like, this is way before 9/11, right? Mm. You go back to the 80s, you have Chuck Norris movies where it's all terrorists. So the propaganda against Muslims and especially Arabs has been going on for many years. Its roots are in the Israel-Palestine conflict, right? Because when Israel is up against, when you look at the Islamophobia industry, a lot of it goes back to pro-Israeli people. Going back to the 70s, this has been documented by scholars. There's a clear overlap between the fact that Israel is at war with Arabs, mm-hmm. and therefore US, Israel's biggest supporter and sponsor, is going to demonize those Arabs. And of course, US was subjected to terrorist attacks because of its support for Israel, many would argue. So it's 100% deliberate.
Someone would listen to you and would say that's a conspiracy theory and...
Which part is a conspiracy theory?
I mean, tying the stereotype in cinema to the whole to the Zionist lobby in the US.
It's not even about the Zionist lobby. It's about the I'm not even getting into lobbies here. I'm talking about the fact that the US government supports Israel, and the US government has for years had a role in Hollywood movies in terms of how US military is protected. Look at the Top Gun movies; they're all made in conjunction with the US military establishment. Of course, it is. Course. Anyone who says otherwise is completely naive. So Hollywood is just one aspect of it. Of course, across the board, the demonization of Muslims and Arabs has been happened, as I say, before 9/11. I joined the media in 2000, 1 year before 9/11. I saw Muslim stereotypes from the inside from well before the war. Obviously, the war on terror took it to another level, right? It gave excuse to everyone to let out all of their fantasies against, killing and torturing and occupying Arab lands. But that has been around for a while. And actually, some may argue that it goes back centuries. It goes back to kind of colonial era. It goes back to, the British Empire. There's all sorts of links you can draw back to why this is the case, right? You could go back centuries to see how the Arabs have been depicted, going back to the Crusades.
Yeah, they say it started really from Orientalism, which was, I think, the 17th century. I'm not too sure, but I think it's around that time when they started.
I mean, Edward Said wrote the book Orientalism, I think, in 1980. So we're talking like, this is around the time of, you could look at the hotspots when this bursts up, the Islamophobic trip. 1979 Iranian Revolution obviously caused a huge amount of paranoia and alarmism in the West about the rise of radical Islam, like 9/11. So they use these excuses to do this stuff, but whether it's conspiracy, whether it's organized, whether it's deliberate, I really don't care. The reality is it's real. Anyone who denies it is denying what's in front of their own eyes. And it's grown. It's gotten much worse. As you point out, with Ukraine, it's become so obvious, the double standard. Mm. And I think we have to call it out when we see it. And, I live in the US where there's been a lot of talk about anti-Semitism on campus and the rise of anti-Jewish hatred post October 7th. And no one's talking about what's happening with Islamophobia. You have a little boy, a six-year-old boy in Illinois, stabbed to death 27 times shortly after October 7th, right? You have Arab-American kids wearing kufayas, shot, one of them now disabled for life, right? This is what's happening in the US right now in terms of anti-Arab demonization and hatred and violence. And it just doesn't get the same level of courage at all.
Mm. Speaking of October 7th, you took a very unpopular position in the Western media supporting Palestine. You're very opinionated about it,
yep.
And you've been on many shows. How was that experience for you? If how it started and how it is now, if you're able to tell us.
I mean, look, to go back to what I was just saying about campuses, people talk about cancel culture in the West. Oh, conservatives have been complaining for years, cancel culture. If you say something liberals don't like, they'll cancel you, they'll end your career. The greatest victims of cancel culture are Palestinians and supporters of the Palestinian cause in the media, in politics, in academia. That's indisputable. Look at the evidence over the years. Politicians who have spoken out in favor of Palestine, been primaried, been had their careers destroyed, been deselected. Just recently, Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, two members of Congress who were very pro-Palestinian. AIPAC spent $23 million to help displace them from their constituencies. In fact, they spent more money in Jamal Bowman's district in New York than entire Western countries spend on their elections, right? So cancel culture is a real thing for people who speak out on Palestine. Their careers can be destroyed. This goes back decades in places like Britain, France, the United States, Canada, where else? So for me, it's always been an issue. And I've had people tell me over the years, friends of mine, just tone down the stuff on Palestine. If you want to be successful in the mainstream, maybe just tone some of that stuff down. And I was like, well, we'll see if and when I hit that glass ceiling. And look, I may have got a little too relaxed in the sense that that, you know, I was at Al Jazeera English and The Intercept, and I was very outspoken on Palestine then, and I still got hired by MSNBC, to be fair to NBC. And I always want to be fair to NBC. I know they canceled my show as I left. But they hired me in 2020 knowing what my views were. It's not like my views were hidden.
That's exactly what my question was. They knew what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah.
And with that, you were canceled.
You'd have to ask them why they canceled me, but my views were always very consistent. If you look at my 3.5 years at MSNBC, pre-October 7th, I was very critical of Israel. I did segments on my show about apartheid, about the American-Palestinian elderly man who was killed in IDF custody. I did so many stories and no issues. Obviously, after October 7th, it's a different issue. They would say they canceled it for business reasons. Other people have other views. But look, my position is, I left MSNBC and set up Zateo, my media company, because I wanted to be able to speak completely freely on Palestine, on Trump, on whatever issues in the news, and not have to worry. The beauty of independent journalism, you'd have to worry about a corporate boardroom or a boss or a CEO or an advertiser. You'd have to keep looking over your shoulder. You know, recently I got into a row with Meghan McCain, the right-wing TV host, daughter of the late John McCain, and she said she was tweeting some stuff suggesting I'm an extremist. And I was like, who is this for? Like, the days have gone when you can try and intimidate me in that way. Yeah. But look, I've never allowed anyone to intimidate me in this issue, because the Palestine issue, history will judge. I have no doubt in my mind, just as with South African apartheid, history will judge who was on the right side and who was on the wrong side. So I don't care if people try and cancel me now. I don't care if people try and smear me as an anti-Semite now. I don't care if people say, why are you obsessed with this issue? I know that history will look back and say who in the media was on the right side and who was on the wrong side. I want to be one of those people on the right side. The author Omar Al-Akkar has a book coming out saying one day when this is all over, everyone will say they opposed it.
My question is, so you had to go and set up Zateo. So the first question that comes to my mind is, how free is free speech in mainstream media from your experiences? So when put to test, you were cancelled. When we all know we've been cancelled, whether it's for business reasons or something else.
So it's a good question. And look, I want to be very cognizant of two things. Let me say two things here, both connect. Number one, remember I said a moment ago, I said, look, I'm proud to be an American based on the values of America and the constitutional values. Yeah. The First Amendment, free press, free speech, standing up to tyranny, all of that stuff I'm in favor of. Whether it's in practice, that's what we can come to. But the values that the country is built on and the laws that are supposed to be in place, I support. We're in the Middle East. We're in the Gulf right now. I wish the Gulf and the Middle East had free press and free speech laws like the US has. I just want to be clear about that. Having said that, of course, by US standards, I'm not going to compare the US to Kuwait or to China or Russia. I'm going to compare the US to US values. And when you compare US to US values, it doesn't meet up to it, obviously. We're seeing that in real life. We're seeing that not just through Donald Trump and the presidency and the new Republican administration already cracking down on freedoms and, you know, threatening the media, which they're doing openly. But also, as you say, the more implicit canceling, you know, the withdrawal of job offers. And you're seeing this on campus. Catherine Frank, a professor of law at Columbia, was just fired by Columbia because she spoke out against what she thought were returning ex-Israeli soldiers on campus. And she was accused of racism, of anti-Semitism, and lost her job. So, of course, there's a huge... And what really bothers me is all the people who complained about cancel culture for years, who are like, oh, this speaker got protested, or this person said cultural appropriation in the canteen. None of them are saying anything now when there's actual people being fired for their views over Israel-Palestine. And not just Israel-Palestine. There's a meteorologist, a weather girl, to use old parlance, which we know, a meteorologist, a female meteorologist on local TV in America who criticized Elon Musk for his Nazi-looking salute.
Yeah.
Fired.
Do you think that was a Nazi salute, though?
I think it was a salute that Nazis liked. Let me put it that way. All the Nazis loved it. I mean, I don't know what's, you know, the line, we don't know what's in his heart. We don't know what's ahead. I don't know what he did. Okay, put that to one side. The Nazis went crazy loving it. And then Elon Musk this weekend, before we're speaking, turned up at the AFD conference virtually to praise Germany's far right and to say Germany should stop being guilty about the Holocaust. Doesn't help your image when after you're accused of doing a Nazi salute, you turn up at a German far right conference and say Germany should stop talking about the Holocaust, stop being guilty about Nazism. Not helpful. But my point being is, whether you think it is or not, what happened to free speech? Shouldn't she be able to say whatever she wants? Isn't that what we're told? After Charlie Hebdo, we Muslims were told, oh, you should have thicker skins. If people want to insult your prophet, that's Western values. So you can insult the prophet of Islam, but don't insult Elon Musk. Don't insult Donald Trump. Don't insult Benjamin Netanyahu. Okay. We see the double standard.
Okay, so some might argue and say, well, I own the news channel. And you also mentioned it in one of your interviews that there are... Sometimes corporate, financial, yes, and ideological pressures, yes, in mainstream media.
Of course.
And that there is a trade-off.
Yes.
And we all welcome trade-off, yeah, because we need, agreed, to work around them, which is fine.
Agreed.
But what is an example? Now, before I speak about the line of where the trade-off is, what do we mean by trade-off? Let's speak about it more practically. You've been in many, TV stations. You started in from BBC, the, yep, ITV, yep, Al Jazeera, you name it.
Sky News.
You worked with them all.
Yeah.
What's a typical trade-off?
It's a good question because it depends on where you are and what period of time you're in. Like I said, when I worked for Al Jazeera English in 2016, 2017, after Eric Prince, I became very well known in American media. I started doing American TV hits. People said to me, oh, it's only a matter of time until CNN or MSNBC hire you. And I would laugh at them and say, why would they hire me? Have you seen my views? Have you seen the way I do interviews? Have you seen what I've said about Middle East stuff? They're not going to hire me. I was convinced they're not going to hire me because trade-offs, I'm way past that trade-off. Yeah. But MSNBC, to be fair to Phil Griffin, who was president of MSNBC at the time, did like my interviewing style, did think I was a good journalist and hired me, knowing about my opinions. And I said, you know, I did my show the way I wanted to do my show. But of course, there's always that when you're in a corporate media channel or any kind of mainstream media, even Al Jazeera, there are trade-offs. No one's under any illusions. Wherever you are, you know there are certain things that they don't want you to say, that they'd rather you didn't say, that they'd rather you say in this way. I don't know if you're following the US media debate right now. None of them are saying, if you look at the US cable channel, none of them are calling it a Nazi salute, the Elon Musk thing. Now, partly that may be because they're worried about being sued. Right now, Trump and the Republicans are suing anyone they don't like. But partly it's just, let's just be cautious, keep our heads down, not say anything too outspoken. There's that mentality within US corporate media. So, of course, look, there are trade-offs and all these things. And I tell this to young Muslim journalists and Arab American journalists and British, Pakistani, British Palestinian journalists, all of them, I say the same thing, like, be careful, right? You're walking a fine line. You want to be able to speak your mind and be authentic. But also, there's no value in just committing career suicide either. Like, a lot of people say to me, oh, we're so glad you're not at MSNBC. Zatteo's great. You can say whatever you want now, but I'm 45, right? I wouldn't have done Zatteo at 25, probably. I mean, it's a different time. We didn't have these kind of independent platforms. But I do value the experiences I had in mainstream media, but also the impact I had, not just in front of a camera. People have no idea the kind of arguments, debates I've had behind the scenes with bosses, with editors, with producers to try and get them to change Islamophobic script lines. Or I remember when I was at one media company, I won't say the name, they wanted to use the azar as like a musical backdrop to a package about terrorism. I was like, you can't do that, right? So this kind of stuff, like behind the scenes, being in the room, to go back to what I said at the start about being, you know, not everyone should become doctors. I want to see Muslims in mainstream media. I want to see Muslims at CNN and MSNBC, at the BBC, because I do believe, A, every minority group should be represented just as a moral, ethical principle. But it's good to have our voices in there, making clear what we actually think. You know, when the grooming gang story, which Musk promoted recently, all the usual far-right tropes about Pakistani men in the UK, if only we had a few more British Pakistani journalists and politicians to push back against that. So I'm all in favor of that. But yes, to go back to your question, sometimes you have to play the game.
You have to play the
game. You have to walk on that tightrope.
How do you keep the balance?
It's very hard to abstract without being able to tell you lots of stories that I can't tell you.
You can't tell anybody. Tell us one story. We don't have to mention the TV program.
But I think the key is, I think it's about intent, right? Look, I'm a Muslim. I have a certain value system. Part of my value system is intent. So to go back to the point about, like, you don't know what's in Elon Musk's heart. People don't know what's in my heart. I've been attacked by so many people in our community who say, oh, you're a sellout. You work for corporate media. Oh, you're this, you're that. You told people what they want to hear to get to where you are. But my position is, have I made compromises along the way? Of course I have. It'd be insane for me to say otherwise. But have I done stuff that I am guilty about ethically? Or did I cross any ethical? No. Did I do anything intentionally to screw people over or to betray people? No, right? So even on Palestine, there are times when I phrase something in a way that maybe you would like to be phrased in a stronger way or blunter way. But the way I phrased it allowed me to get that point out and to a mainstream bigger audience. So I think there's certain things you have to understand. Now, look, I'm at Zatteo now. I run my own media company.
Yeah.
I say whatever the hell I want. I don't answer to anyone but God, right? So it's a different world. But I'm 45 years old. I've been in the media for over 20 years and 2 cities. Not everyone can do what I'm doing. I get that. So to younger journalists coming through, I say, look, understand where the trade-offs and lines are. Try and push the line. That's what I always try to do. One of the things I try to do is find the line and how much can you push it without crossing over, right? Where is it? And also, how can you, to go back to the book I wrote, How can you persuade the people around you to see the world that you're seeing? If I can persuade other people to see the world the way I'm seeing it, then even if I'm not there, at least I've changed some hearts and minds that they will understand, okay, well, we shouldn't do the package in this way. We should, like, one thing I did at MSNBC is I've pushed for a diversity of guests. Right? That's one thing I did. Try and have more diverse voices on air.
The Chomsky story.
Chomsky. Palestinians. Like, there's no Palestinians on air on American TV. It's always Americans and Israelis talking about the Middle East. There's no actual Palestinian voices. I pushed, my colleague Ayman Mouyoudine, we pushed to get Palestinian voices on air. I hope that lasts even with me not at that network. I pushed for interviewers to do tougher interviews. I think people are starting to do tougher interviews. Not only because of me, but I think I helped push American TV journalism in that direction. So that's another part of it, right? Even if you're not able to kind of burn the red line, can you push people in a certain direction?
Mm. So, you look at things practically.
Yes.
And but there are things...
You can be a pragmatist without being a sellout. I think that's what I would like to say to your audience.
Ooh, yeah. Can you?
Yes, you can. 100%. 100%. I don't think we should see pragmatism as some form of inherent evil. Yeah. I think, you know... I don't want to get into Islamic history here, but, you know, example that I take, I'm someone who, you know, is a Muslim. I look at the Prophet and I would say the Prophet of Islam signed the Hudaybiyah Treaty, which at the time was seen by a lot of his own companions as, what is he doing? I think there's always a place for pragmatism, depending on your intent, depending on what you're trying to achieve, depending on what the circumstances you find yourselves in, how much freedom of action you have. But look, you know, there's preaching to the converted is not enough for me. I could go and have a great Arab, Muslim, lefty audience.
Yeah.
And even Zateo, I set up Zateo not to just have an audience at Echo Chamber. I'm trying to get a broader audience out there.
And that's because you can end up in a bubble. And
you end up in a bubble. People say, oh, why do you go on Piers Morgan? And I said, because he's got a huge audience, right? And, you know, he and I don't agree. And sometimes the debate's not always in good faith. But the audience is a massive audience. So I wouldn't go on Fox because I do have red lines.
There was a moment, though, with Piers Morgan. I'm trying to remember the moment where he said something and then you stopped him and then you kind of showed how he said another point before and how it went against the point that you... I can't remember the one. Do you remember which one I'm trying to get to?
That's happened a few times.
There was one which you were sat next to him.
Yeah, in London, yeah.
In London.
I did one on set with him. That was the week of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and we talked about Hezbollah.
Is he tough in general? Is he one of the tough people in media to...
In what sense?
To debate or argue with.
Only because he's slippery. I think Piers, it's very hard. He's like a jello, as the Americans say, or jelly in the UK.
Yeah.
Like, pin him to the wall. He, you know, if you try and get him, I interviewed him. I actually had him on my show. Every time I go on his show and I push him, he says, "Manny, it's my show. You don't get to ask me questions." I was like, "Okay, you're coming on my." Finally, I persuaded him in New York. He came on my show.
I saw that.
And then I was able, and even there, like, for example, his views on Trump, he's gone full, you know, 180. After January 6th, he was calling Trump despicable. He should be pushed from the presidency. So I said to him, how do you change your view? Although that was then, this is now. Okay, but why? What's changed? Trump hasn't become less despicable or less insane. He's become more, many would argue. Mm. And now he just dodged it. Many, I'm not going to say that. Okay, but... So he's one of those guys that's hard to pin to the wall. What's interesting is he claims to be neutral. I've said this to his face if he's watching. You know, he's not. He's a right-winger. He's a conservative. He wants to be close to Trump, wants to get an interview with Trump. So that affects a lot of his journalism. But look, I don't go on some of his crazier panels. I try and avoid those.
Yeah, I realize you don't go on the panels.
The panels are like, they're called nowadays the Jerry Springer of political television. It's just people shouting at each other. He had the QAnon shaman, the guy from January 6th who was pardoned. He came on his panel. I was like, well, that's crazy. I wouldn't go on. So I did one panel of his, which was in person in New York because I got to be on with Sarah Palin. And I just thought it's funny. I never thought in my life I'd get to be on a panel with Sarah Palin. And I got to have a go, which I did. And it went viral. But I try and avoid the panels and try and do one-on-ones. Or occasionally I get to debate an Israeli. A lot of Israelis won't come on my show. Some do. We had Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister. But it's a good opportunity to debate Israelis on the Piers Morgan show. That's another opportunity. But I try and avoid some of the crazier panels. Look, my thing about debate, I wrote a book about debate, is I'm all for debate. I'll have a debate with anyone as long as it's in good faith. I don't want to do these pointless, just performative nonsense. Nowadays, the internet and YouTube and social media has encouraged this idea of just people shouting at each other, saying nonsense to each other to get clicks. It's not worth my while.
But you were able to deconstruct the Israeli narrative in the media, and there are specific talking.
They hate me for it.
They do. I mean, but there are specific talking points which they bring up every now and again. Did you feel that those debates in the past 16 months? Were from a different kind of debates comparing to the ones that you did before October 7th. Do you think like you entered a new territory now?
I think they're easier, to be honest, because the narrative has crumbled. It's very hard for the Israelis to defend what they're doing.
Do you feel that the narrative and the general discourse has crumbled?
They know it. They're panicking. They know that their Hasbara talking points don't work anymore. They know that what worked for the first month in November, December, Hamas, doesn't work anymore. I mean, you mentioned Piers Morgan. Piers knows there's a meme that makes fun of him that he's sitting next to a baby and he says, "What about Hamas? Do you condemn Hamas?" So, that didn't work. When the entire humanitarian and human rights world is against you. I mean, when I debated this Israeli colonel on CNN, same guy I debated on Piers Morgan, I forget his name. I said to him, well, he wants you to believe that him and Netanyahu and the Israeli military are telling the truth, but Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, Beth Salem, Yesh Din, Oxfam, Save the Children, Refugees International, International Rescue, UNICEF, UNHCR, the list goes. They're all lying, right? They're all not telling the truth, but trust the Israeli military. It just doesn't go anywhere. They know they have no credibility. They know their talking points are BS. And that's why it's not just me. A lot of really eloquent pro-Palestinian journalists, activists have gone on television and done a really good job. I think that it's been clear to any neutral person, if such a neutral person exists, have lost the propaganda media war, which they were very good at. I mean, people like me spent years going, oh man, the Israelis are so good at messaging. They're so good at PR. They win all the media battles. They're so prepared. Our side is always so weak.
Yeah.
I think since October 7th, they've been all over the place. They've seen, all their narratives of beheaded babies and the hospital nonsense and all
the
that stuff.
And all that.
All of that that's fallen apart. I mean, look, interestingly, you mentioned rape, right? Yeah. And it's something, a very sensitive subject. My position on that is the UN Commission of Inquiry that wasn't allowed into Israel said that they did find evidence of sexually based and gender violence, SBGV, which happened on October 7th post. They didn't find any evidence of rape and they would like to investigate further. The Israelis said no. My position is very simple. I said this in a debate when Piers Morgan brought it up. Oh, they try and do it as a gotcha. Oh, you're a rape denier. My position is there are accusations of rape and sexual violence on both sides. Investigate them all. There's only one party that doesn't want an investigation. It's Israel. What has Israel got to hide? In fact, just recently, the UN spokeswoman on violence against women tried to enter Israel to investigate this. But she said, I also need to investigate Palestinian detainees. And they said no. So, people, I don't need to get into a debate about is it true, is it not true? All I need to point out is the Israelis don't want an investigation. Why is that?
Do you think it's reflecting behind closed doors? And you're in the industry.
100%.
Yeah, has it changed?
100%. Now, are people still fearful behind closed doors? Are people willing to speak out? Again, we've seen more and more people speak out. You saw them go crazy when Hollywood actors wore the pins. You saw the attacks on people like Mark Ruffalo and Billie Eilish. It's like, you're insane. Like, I did a story for Zateo on how, everyone's an anti-Semite. Everyone is Hamas, right? And I just listed, there's a kids' TV presenter, huge on YouTube, Miss Rachel. Like, anyone with a small child knows Miss Rachel. Like, she was accused of being, a Hamas supporter. It's like, you've lost your mind. If you say anything vaguely, I don't like to see Palestinian children being killed, suddenly you're a Hamas apologist. So they've been so extreme in the way they've thrown that around. They've emptied anti-Semitism, which is a real thing, a real problem. They've emptied it of all meaning. Hamas, everyone's Hamas. If the Pope is now Hamas, because he came out and said, we should investigate this, we should stop the killing. So in that sense, that's the sign of... like I said, I've written a book on debate and argument. You know when someone is losing a debate and argument, when they are flailing and just throwing out name-calling and tired talking points that have been debunked.
Talking points, speaking of, my last thing I want to talk to you about is the US, really. And recently, Trump came out and said that he wants to move Palestinians from Gaza.
Yeah, clear out the Gaza Strip.
He said, literally, we just clean out, the whole thing. Isn't that a clear example of ethnic cleansing?
100%. How the media reported it? Oh, he wants to... Controversial remarks. Astonishing remarks. He wants to move people out as if it's some humanitarian gesture, which I'm sure he'll portray it as. No, of course it's ethnic cleansing. Again, if Vladimir Putin said, I want to move everyone out of the Donbass for their own safety, they should go live in Italy or Germany, what would the West say? What would the West say? I mean, I said before, just take Ukraine. Anytime you have any doubt about how Palestine is being covered, just look at Ukraine. Would we be okay with Vladimir Putin saying, well, they're all Europeans, they're all white? By the way, there's such racism in the discourse around Palestine. It's always this Arabs, the Arabs. We don't talk about the Europeans in that way. We don't say that the Europeans should all just absorb Ukrainians because they're all blonde-haired, blue-eyed. This idea that Palestinians with their own nationality, their own culture, their own history should just go live in Egypt because it's the same thing is absurd. It's
exactly.
Racist.
Exactly.
And look, I would say this. I'm sure many of your audience in the Gulf are sympathizers with Donald Trump. I know he has a lot of fans in the Gulf region. You've been lied to, is what I would say to your viewers and listeners. I know a lot of Muslims, a lot of Arabs who had a very soft spot for Trump. They thought, oh, he didn't start any wars in the Middle East.
Look,
which
was
not true.
The thing that they like about Trump, if you want me to be honest, is his very strong position on LGBT and this gender news.
That's part of it.
Yeah.
But also there is this running theme that, well, he's not as pro-war as the Democrats. He's not a neocon. He's not a Zionist. He didn't start, you hear this line? I hear this line all the time. He didn't start any wars in the Middle East, which is a complete lie. He killed Qasem Soleimani in Iraq and tried to start a war with Iran. He helped Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. He did more drone strikes in his first 2 years than Obama did in 8 years. People don't know this stuff. He bombed Syria twice. So it's just nonsense, his first term. And now his second term, he's got Mike Huckabee, who says there's no such thing as Palestinians, as his ambassador to Israel. Yeah. He has Elise Stefanik, a woman who got rid of, who forced out the presidents of Harvard and MIT because they're anti-Semites, as ambassador to the UN. He's got Peter Hegseth, just got confirmed as defense secretary, a man who allegedly was so drunk he was pulled out of a bar screaming, kill all Muslims. He's now the defense secretary of the United States. Marco Rubio is secretary of state, hardcore neoconservative, would love a war with China, would love a war with Venezuela, would love a war with Iran. Right? These are the people staffing up his administration. Right? They are very, very hawkish, very anti-Arab, very anti-Muslim. So this idea that he's somehow a peaceful person or anti-war, anti-intervention, it's just not true. I'm sorry, I feel very strongly about this. And the Gaza stuff, I was told, oh, you need to apologize. You said that Trump would be worse than Harris on Gaza, but he did a ceasefire. He didn't do a ceasefire. He did a temporary pause in the fighting for his inauguration. There is no ceasefire. Phases 2 and 3, I'm saying it here, I'm happy to come back and apologize, are not going to happen in the way the deal is. Netanyahu's already violating. They're already killing people in Gaza and the West Bank. Before I came here today, I watched a clip of Israeli soldiers wearing women's underwear in the West Bank now. They're doing the same genocidal, racist crap that they did in Gaza. They're doing it in the West Bank. And now, yes, these comments are a reminder that he doesn't care about Palestinians. No. Of course he doesn't. He cares about himself. And if he thinks that solves the problem, he says Gaza could be like Monaco. Jared Kushner said it could be beachfront property. That's how they see land, wow. Right? In that perspective, even in these comments, he said, oh, you clear it out and make it into a new place. That's what the Israeli far right wants. Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, they're already praising Trump.
Yeah,
as
they welcomed his comments.
They would love that. I went on Piers Morgan, he said to me, if they're not after Hamas, why are they doing it, Mehdi? And I said, to depopulate Gaza. And I stand by that. And Trump's remarks are another reminder of that is the end goal always, is to ethnically cleanse the people from Gaza. That's always been the goal.
What's crazy is our next episode coming out in a few days is about Donald Trump. And we will break down all of the people appointed. And just like the few characters that you've mentioned and many more, how they are not as good for the Middle East and America as we might think, opposite to his propaganda where he said he's going to create a golden era. But with that said, what I really want to get to is where is America going? Or where is the United States going for the next four years? Where do you think?
God help us. Not going in a good direction.
You don't think so?
So far, not so good. I mean, we've only had a week of his presidency and it's already been pretty authoritarian. It's been pretty anti-democratic. It's not been good on big issues like climate change. He said, I'm the guy. Remember, why did he win the election? Number one reason he ran the election is because people were upset the prices were too high, right? Fundamentally, there were many other reasons, but that was the main reason that got swing voters. Yeah. Inflation, egg prices, grocery prices, gas prices. Egg prices are massively high. We may have another bird flu pandemic. Good luck to us if we have another pandemic on Donald Trump's watch, anti-vaxxer at the health secretary. So inflation was his big issue, but he's done nothing since he became president to tackle inflation. The opposite. He's obsessed with taking Greenland from Denmark, annexing Canada and making it the 51st state, taking back the Panama Canal. And just yesterday, he started a fight with Colombia, right? So this guy is a wrecking ball. He's always been a human wrecking ball on the international stage. His supporters say, well, people respect us now. People actually laughed in his face at the UN General Assembly, if you remember correctly. When people say, what's going to happen in the next 4 years? I can't tell you what's going to happen in the next 4 weeks, Faisal, because he's completely erratic every day. If I told you 2 weeks ago he's going to be ringing the Danish Prime Minister insisting on taking Greenland, you wouldn't have believed me. If I told you before the election, forget Iran, he might start a war with Denmark and Panama, you would say, what? This guy makes stuff up as he goes along. And I think if you look at the first term, no one saw a lot of what was coming. Not just the once in a century pandemic, but a lot of what he did. To the point where, when he left office as the most unpopular president for a long time. Right now, he's super popular by his standards. I mean, still under 50%, but he's more popular relatively than he's ever been. Yes. He controls all branches of government. The media is afraid of him. Social media bosses turned up at his inauguration to bow their knees to him. He's in a very powerful, influential position. Those of us who are critics of his should be worried because he's going to use the power of the state against independent media. A lot of us are worried what's going to happen to journalists for the next few years. He's threatening to crack down on media licenses. He's suing people. But no one can predict what's going to happen.
There are points which they bring up, and the Trump promoters, let's say, is about what happened during the pandemic, for example, and what happened, what the deep state was doing during the pandemic and what affected the whole world. And Mark Zuckerberg came out on Joe Rogan and kind of admitted that he was pressured by the government in terms of
anything. He said what people want to hear.
In terms of hiding any form of information about the side effects of the vaccines. Things like that just makes people think a little bit, that is he going to fight the deep state?
So hold on. If you're worried about free speech, as we discussed earlier, he's not a supporter of free speech. Donald Trump supports anyone who's... He supports speech he likes, right? So that's why he's the guy threatening media organizations. And Zuckerberg is a hypocrite. When he comes on Joe Rogan and says, oh, they rang me and they swore at me and they told me take this stuff down. Donald Trump said he's going to put Mark Zuckerberg in prison. Can you show me the time where Joe Biden threatened Zuckerberg with prison? He threatened to put the man in prison. In fact, recently at a press conference, Trump was asked, do you think Mark Zuckerberg has become pro you and rolled over for you because you threatened him? Any other leader in the Western world, in fact, in the Gulf, would say, I never threatened him. You know what Trump said? Yeah, probably. Wow. Like a mob boss. He's proud of it. He goes, yeah, probably. So this idea of like freedom and online, look, I don't want to get into re-prosecute the pandemic. I think a lot of that has been exaggerated. There was a legitimate public health role for the government in the middle of a once-in-a-century pandemic of a brand new illness where people were dying in their thousands on 9/11 every day. I think it was perfectly legitimate for the American government to say, they didn't force anyone. They said, please don't publish misinformation online. Please don't tell people not to mask. Please don't tell people the vaccines are killing people, right? All false. Whether the side effects, that's a different debate. But that was totally legitimate. And if we have a bird flu pandemic now, God help us all, we're going to see how America looks like when there are no restrictions, when people can do whatever they want, when there's no vaccines available. Robert Kennedy Jr. in charge of the health department will be a disaster. And by the way, one last point on Zuckerberg. When he says, oh, the government restricted what we could say in the pandemic, who was the government in 2020?
It was
Trump.
Trump, it was, yes.
So if anyone was restricting Facebook in 2020,
he clearly meant after.
Yeah,
that,
of course, after. But the original things that they get upset about, the schools were closed. Well, when were the schools closed in 2020? Who was president? Donald Trump. My friend Chris Hayes at MSNBC has a great line. He says, the Trump people want you to believe that Donald Trump was only president until the end of 2019. They want you to forget about 2020, the disastrous year, where he, according to the Lancet Medical Journal, thanks to Donald Trump, 200,000 Americans died who didn't need to die.
What do you think about freeing information like the JFK files and the...
I'm all in favor of transparency, but notice which files he didn't release.
9/11?
No.
Which ones?
Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh.
Guess who Jeffrey Epstein called his best friend? Donald Trump. Are we going to end the show on Epstein? What a way to end on Epstein!
No. We're going to end the show on Zatteo because okay. I think I really want to. Because when we looked up Zatteo, we looked up where the word comes from.
Yes,
and it's an ancient Greek word for seeking out and striving. Yes. So my question to you, Mehdi, what are you seeking out through Zatteo?
My daughter's very upset with me. She said, "You're such a self-hater. You should have had an Arabic name for your company. You should have been a Muslim. Why did you go ancient Greek?" That's playing the game. See, you have a nice Greek name. people take me now. No, look, the meaning was great. A colleague of mine discovered, we spent ages thinking, what are we going to call this media company that's not cliched? And the meaning of the word, when my colleague came to me with the name, it really spoke to me, because one of the things we are trying to do is speak truth, uncomfortable truths, in a time when people are trying to crack down on it, whether it's the truth about the rise of fascism or the rise of racism or the genocidal impact of right-wing Zionism. We want to be able to speak out. And we want to also, in an age of misinformation online, where the Zuckerbergs and Musks are helping promote all sorts of conspiracies and nonsense online, we want to kind of sift through that crap, sift through that BS, get through the darkness and bring some light. And that's what our journalism, that's what we try and do with our op-eds, with our videos, with our YouTube shows. We're doing a lot of stuff. We made a documentary last year called Israel's Real Extremism, R-E-E-L, which is all about those soldiers who did TikToks of destroying houses and wearing women's clothing in Gaza. I urge people to go check it out. It's on our website, zatteo.com. But look, we're trying to build independent media. It's a subscription model. For a long time, people on the left, Muslims, people around the world have complained, oh, the media is biased. Oh, Western media is. Okay, but what are you doing about it? I decided to try and do something about it. And I say to people, stop complaining, stop whining and moaning online and do something about it. Support independent media, not just Zatteo. There are a lot of journalists out there doing a lot of good work that need financial support. People say, oh, it's behind a paywall. A lot of what we do is behind a paywall. Yeah, free press isn't free.
Exactly.
We're trying to pay for journalism. We're trying to provide high quality journalism and have a relationship where people feel that they're part of a movement, part of a community to actually tell the truth about what is going on in the world. And that is what Zatteo is about.
Yeah, because that was my second question, really, because when you mentioned independent journalism, journalism, and people were trying to do the same thing. And it's difficult to finance and balance without sponsors and people trying to trying to support you. And we know you have very unpopular opinions for what you're doing.
Exactly. Not many people want to advertise with the guy who's calling what's happening in Gaza genocide in the US right now. A lot of corporations, they don't want to touch anything to do with Israel-Gaza.
What's your strategy for
that? We don't have any advertisers right now, apart from what we get from YouTube ads, which, as you know, is not very much. And we have no sponsors, corporate sponsors, so we're not against that. But right now we have nothing. We are subscriber-driven. We have 350,000 subscribers on Substack, 600,000 subscribers on YouTube. We have nearly 50,000 paid subscribers soon. We're the fourth biggest politics newsletter on Substack in America already. In just 8 months. Really? We've been profiled in the Times and the Post. So people have noticed us. We get big guests. So we're in a strong position. But, you know, to all of your viewers and listeners, if they want to support my journalism now, that's the way. Zeteo.com, Zeteo.com. You know, subscribe and actually support a different way of doing journalism.
We'll have the link in the description.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming to Unscripted. You are unfiltered on your show. This is Bedoun Warak, Unscripted.
So I love being unscripted. I probably said things I'll regret, but thank you, Chris.
thank you for coming.
Thanks so much.
Hope it's not the last time.
No, I hope not.
Thank you. Thank you, Mnira.